Some of the young men who've been arrested in connection with the attack, so young as to be children, really, told police that they were just out wilding.
Before the Central Park Five case was a Netflix series, it was a local news pile-on. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. We think of eviction as a landlord's last resort. Often it's the first, and it can leave a lasting stain.
We've seen probably about 10 apartments, and every apartment, if you've had an eviction, they disqualify you.
What we think we know and what we really don't know about American eviction.
What's really causing this housing crisis? You know, is it a simple story? Is it just a story about supply and demand, or is there something else?
It's all coming up after this.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This year is the 30th anniversary of a criminal case that indelibly stained and, with every ensuing year, seems more to define our society.
Police believe a gang of about 12 young hoodlums is responsible for the vicious rape and beating of a 30-year-old investment banker, Tricia Miley, who was jogging in Central Park last night.
On a springtime evening in 1989, what began as a spree of hooliganism ended with felony arrests of Raymond Santana, Kevin Richardson, Antron McRae, Yusef Salam, and Corey Wise. Quickly branded the Central Park Five, the teenagers were tried and convicted in the press and then in the courts for a gruesome assault on a jogger left for dead. Those verdicts, despite zero physical evidence connecting them to the crime scene, zero eyewitnesses, and an implausible prosecution map and timeline of the events. What sex crimes prosecutor Linda Fairstein did have was video of confessions coerced from the teenagers following hours of interrogation without a lawyer, or in some cases even a parent present. But then a twist, the 2002 confession by the real perpetrator, a serial rapist, and a DNA match confirming his guilt. Their story is the subject of a new Netflix series directed by Ava DuVernay called When They See Us. The release of the film has brought the events of 1989 back into focus, and outrage has ensued, much focused on the ex-prosecutor, who since has achieved success as a crime novelist. An online protest using the hashtag #CancelLindaFairstein has boycotted her books and led to her resignation Tuesday from the Vassar College Board of Trustees. And now activists, including New York City public advocate Jemani Williams, are calling for an investigation into other cases involving Fairstein and trial prosecutor Elizabeth Lederer. The film had a personal resonance for New York Times columnist Jim Dwyer. He covered the trial for New York Newsday back in 1990. Jim, welcome to OTM.
Thank you, Bob.
The narrative at the time, as laid out by the police and prosecutors, was of a rampage. 30 Harlem teenagers running wild in Central Park, harassing and assaulting white passersby, culminating in the savage beating and rape of Patricia Miley. The press more or less passed along that narrative.
Some of the young men told police they were just out wilding.
Wilding is a word you won't find in Webster's.
Wilding. New York City police say that's new teenage slang for rampaging and wolf packs, attacking people just for the fun of it.
The district attorney's
when the press covered this, how uncritically did it treat the prosecution's narrative?
The fact is there was a kind of rampage in the park that night. There were 33 or so teenagers running through the park. In one case, a homeless man was beaten up and his food was taken from him. In another case, a jogger at the Central Park Reservoir, a man, was badly beaten. There were other encounters with bicyclists. Before all of these things had finished, the police were on the scene or on their way. That's how some of the kids were rounded up as they were running from the park. I think it was pretty well established that that was true. What wasn't true was that they then culminated the night by gang raping and nearly murdering Patricia Miley. And that part was accepted uncritically for quite a while.
Is it true that only one of them was identified by an eyewitness?
I mean, I don't want to tell you how to do your job, but you're asking the wrong question. At least two of the five admitted that they went into the park to rob people. So that was admitted in the parole hearings. Were they involved in it? I think that's a very important fact to understanding what happened in the Jogger case. Because the defense wanted to avoid any connection with these other crimes, they went for an all or nothing verdict. And the best defense, the most real defense, was that they could not have raped and assaulted the jogger because at the time that that most likely happened, they were elsewhere in the park causing other trouble. The defense did not raise that at trial.
There's no evidence that all of these kids were guiltless, but in no way connected to the attack on Patricia Miley.
Ed Conlon, a really good writer and a former police officer, wrote a couple of years ago that it's like saying you committed 100 shopliftings, therefore you strangled your grandmother. That's the quantum of difference between the bad activity that the group was involved in elsewhere in the park and the attack on Patricia Miley.
You were covering the story for the late lamented New York edition of Newsday. How would you characterize your coverage during the course of the investigation and the trial?
I would characterize my coverage as not skeptical enough and not following the doubts that I did raise to their logical conclusion. On the day that Jogger herself testified, she came into court. It was clear that the reason she was brought into court had nothing to do with proving the case against the five boys, or actually at that point, three of them were on trial. She had no memory of the event. She had suffered traumatic brain injury. She couldn't see very well. She had a lot of problems walking. It was evident to me at the time that the jogger could offer no testimony or evidence against the defendants who were on trial, but it served to fill the emotional hole left by the absence of any physical evidence. So the other issue to me in the coverage of the trial was the written confessions that were presented in court prior to the boys being videotaped. They all had to sign written statements. They were not the language of 15, 14, 16-year-olds. The language was something like, we did all together, one and the same, with the same intentions, proceed northwest by north. You know, copology. It was just implausible that these words ever sat on the lips of any 14-year-old. And the eldest of the group, Corey Wise, had a very significant hearing deficit. Watching his videotaped confession, you can follow his face as he's trying to read the lips, trying to get cues from the prosecutor who's interrogating him.
The actual perpetrator, Matias Reyes, confessed to the crime, and his DNA matched that found on the victim. The prosecutor in the case, Linda Fairstein, says that, they have not been exonerated. One culprit has confessed. The others were properly prosecuted. What are we to make of this?
When the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, led by Robert Morgenthau, the same person who was in charge during the original prosecution, took the newly available admissions from Matias Reyes and put them into the picture, it showed to him that no guilty verdict against those five would have been sustained. In fact, Morgenthau told me that he could not have reached probable cause, which is the standard for indictment, to charge those five, given the information that Reyes had presented to them. It exposed all the weaknesses in the case. I think there's no way that any reasonable person can say that this was good law enforcement when a predator who had attacked a woman in that same area of the park 2 days before and was identified by that victim and then goes on to attack four more people and murder one, that this was a successful prosecution, that this was a wise and efficient use of law enforcement.
As I watch this film, the holes in the prosecution are so gaping. Exculpatory evidence was withheld from the defense. The lack of a DNA match, the defense didn't know about it until they heard about it at trial. Beginning with you, why did you not seize on it more? You say you mentioned it in your coverage, but you didn't go on a repertorial tear, did you?
No, I didn't. I accepted the narrative that there had been a gang rape. I just did not accept the plausibility of some of the individual accounts of it. That was my fatal error. Why didn't I? Well, I don't know why I didn't. I think all of us have learned a lot in the last 30 years about the ability of people to be coerced or pressed into giving statements against themselves. That's been very evident from the era of DNA exonerations that we've been living through. It was not as evident to me. It was counterintuitive to me that three boys would go on video cameras with their parents sitting in the room and confess to this awful crime. Today, it does make sense, a lot more sense, not because of this case alone, but because of many, many other cases. And the reality is that voluntariness is a much different concept than reliability.
We've discussed your experience covering the story and lingering regrets about what you did not do. In the intervening time, among your many books, one is on wrongful conviction. Was it that case that put that into your head?
I would say that my interest in the workings and misworkings of the justice system was stimulated before I realized how badly the Central Park Five case had been bungled by the system and by the reporters like myself. And my interest was certainly enhanced when I realized how screwed up we had gotten it later on. I had forgotten that I had any doubts about the case when they were exonerated, sad to say.
You know, I was prepared to ask you why it's lingered with everybody else, but now that you mention it, I don't think it has lingered. I think it happened. It was in the public's eye and mind at the time. But now, with Ava DuVernay's miniseries, they're back. And I'm tempted to say, with a vengeance.
You know what? There's a lot that still to learn about this case. And I intend to learn it.
Jim, thank you.
You're welcome.
Jim Dwyer is a columnist for The New York Times.
Coming up, unmasking an American disaster hiding in plain sight, the eviction crisis.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. It seems our nation has finally arrived at the point where nobody can plausibly contend that America is what it claims to be, much less what it ought to be. So what ought we to be? We first launched the project of examining our founding falsehoods with a limited series, Busted, America's Poverty Myths. Now we're producing another. It's called The Scarlet E, Unmasking America's Eviction Crisis.
My name is Damon. When I first started, you know, having house problems is when my grandma had left to West Virginia, because when she was here, she was the main person that actually helped with everybody to have a stable home. But it had changed dramatically.
Eviction sucks all calm from life, trailing chaos in its wake. And the research tells us it eats children most of all. In fact, the data suggests that the presence of children actually increases the likelihood of eviction. Damon is enrolled in Change the World, a support program for homeless youth.
At the time, my mom, she had had to get surgery on her back, so I had to be there. So she couldn't go to work to make the money to pay the bills. That day, when we came back from the hospital, they actually turned our electricity off. And I've been basically sitting in the dark for like almost a month. So I was taking care of my mom like that. So that's when we lost the house.
Since the mid-90s until very recently, lower incomes mostly stagnated as median rents soared. Starting this project, I thought I understood the gist of the problem. The lack of jobs? Nope. Hollowed out industrial centers? Mm-mm. How about a lack of available actual housing? Not so much. The lack of affordable housing? Unquestionably. But why? It turns out it's not so much about poverty as it is about extracting wealth from people who earn the lowest wages, especially black and brown people, by charging more for less. Richmond's not a pricey place to live, but it's the second most evicting city in the nation.
When I started down here in the Commonwealth of Virginia, my first job was security. I was promised a certain amount of hours, certain amount of pay, and that didn't happen. We got caught up in the whole, well, we work you this week, but we might not work you next week. Or we work you next week, and then you might not work again.
Jeffrey's got natural resolve, but there's desperation beneath the calm. A couple of years ago, he moved his family of five to Richmond so his wife Kelly could care for her ailing mom. Then he sprang for more training to up his pay. But he also was carrying a $900 rent, which, because of his unreliable hours, actually was more than he was making. He got behind. In Richmond, the median amount for which a landlord files eviction is just $836.
When we woke up that morning, they knocked on the door and said, we gotta get out.
His son Jalen was 9, getting ready for school when the police knocked on the door.
We had to take our stuff out the house. We couldn't take all our stuff. They just said, just get some clothes on and leave.
After the kids left for school, Jeffrey and Kelly packed the essentials, work stuff, medicine, some clothes, and retreated to a nearby bus stop to keep watch on the possessions heaped on the lawn, stuff they could neither carry nor store, much of which, wedding pictures, kids' trophies and awards, a decent TV, they knew they'd never see again. Then the kids returned.
My son looked at me and said, Dad, this is not your fault.
They couldn't stay with relatives because they were renters too and their leases restricted occupancy. So Jeffrey, Kelly, Jalen, a 9-year-old daughter and another in high school, both with special needs, now live in a pay-by-the-week motel. 5 people, 2 beds, 1 room, 21 months and counting, and then abruptly kicked out. Now they live in another hotel for $100 more than before. Kelly's frustration is bone deep. They just needed more time.
He got the position that he was trained for, so he was promoted and making the income now.
They are caught in a snare, one that's entrapped millions of others.
The one thing that hampers us now is the fact that we've seen probably about 10 apartments, and every apartment, if you've had an eviction, they disqualify you.
Anybody can fall on hard times.
Christy Mara is with the Virginia Poverty Law Center.
That can cause them to miss a rent payment, which can cause them to get evicted. Now, they may get a better job a week after they get evicted, right? But now they've got what I call the Scarlet E. They have the Scarlet E, and when they go to look for their next apartment or house, that Scarlet E pops up. And the reputable landlords often don't want to rent to them, and they wind up renting from people who are cutting corners, who are overcharging, and it just starts the cycle all over again.
2 years ago, the Federal Reserve found that 44% of us couldn't cover a sudden $400 expense without borrowing or selling something. And so if you don't have family or friends you can tap, anything unexpected, health issues, accidents, car trouble, reduced work hours, can trigger calamity cascades. Jay reached for the mic to interview his dad.
Is it hard to be working, do stuff to pay for the room?
It is. We try to do our best, I think, and kind of keeping you guys not worrying. But behind the scenes, it's a lot of stress and aggravation and making phone calls and reaching out. It can be hard at times. But as your mom and dad, that's what we're here for. How do you feel when you see mom and dad stressing about trying to pay for the hotel room? How does it affect you?
I feel sad every time they say try to kick us out. I say why.
The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, classifies families that spend more than 30% of their income on rent as rent burdened. According to Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies, that applies to nearly half of all U.S. renters, which means they probably scrimp on other vital expenses to hold on to their homes. Now, obviously, the more you make, the less you're burdened. If you're comfortably above the poverty line, maybe you'll have some left over for healthy food, medicine, or emergencies. But the minimum wage is not likely to put you there. In fact, there is no state in the union where you can rent a modest two-bedroom apartment working full-time, hell, more than full-time, on the minimum wage. Even a $15 minimum wouldn't do it in the vast majority of states. Jeffrey makes more than the minimum wage, but when we called him to follow up a couple of months after our visit, he was still contending with that scarlet E.
It's almost like a spin cycle that you just don't get off, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We're still reaching out to agencies. I'm waiting for agencies to call me back, and we're putting in application fees. We're trying every which way possible to reach out to this person, that person. Mm-hmm. You know, as a father, I feel like I'm failing them. My son, Jalen, the one you met,
mm-hmm.
he's actually ashamed to even tell his friends that he stays in a hotel. He stays at a friend's house, and the parent wants to drop him off. Well, he'll give them a house that's not a hotel mm-hmm. just so they won't know that he stays in a hotel. Out of all the things that kids should normally have to worry about, a roof over their head and food in their stomach should not be one of them. And it's kind of disheartening because people are coming in after us and we're finding out a couple weeks later, hey, I found me a place. Well, I'm like, well, what are we doing wrong? And that's the frustrating part. You know, you see all these good stories mm-hmm. and things happening for good people. And then you start to reevaluate your life, reevaluate if you've done things correctly. And me and my wife have always taught our kids that no matter how life throws you a curveball, you have to manage to stay in the game no matter what.
Most likely, families like Jeffrey's live in your community. You just don't see them. They may be in shelters or broken up or couch surfing or pay-by-the-week motels. The blunt truth, millions of hardworking men and women cannot afford a family. Does that mean they haven't earned one? That they don't deserve one? Is that the American way? That's not right. That can't be right. No moral code or ethical principle, no piece of scripture or holy teaching can be summoned to defend what we have allowed our country to become. That was written by sociologist Matthew Desmond, who's the expert, the advocate, the guy on eviction. He joins us in a minute.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Now I want to introduce you to Matthew Desmond. He is our partner in this eviction project and the inspiration for it. His best-selling Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City, limned the whys and wherefores of eviction, but especially the people, by following for many months renters in Milwaukee's worst trailer park, inhabited by whites mostly, and renters in Milwaukee's black inner city. Not long after Evicted took off, we called him for our poverty series. A couple of years later, he called us for this. So, what's our job here? I mean, mine and Eve's and Katie's and John's, the team that's making this podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. We're in the middle of a housing crisis that is affecting big cities, small cities, rural communities. What's really causing this housing crisis? You know, is it a simple story? Is it just a story about supply and demand, or is there something else going on? I think there's moral questions about there about, you know, if this is going to be a business, you know, if people are going to make money off this, how much should they make? And how much inequality can we tolerate? And what are the stories about what's working all around the country? And maybe most important, what is the wreckage like? You know, what is this problem doing to our kids and our schools and our families? For me anyways, like, the reporting on this story is stuck in a bit of a rut. Gee, it's really expensive to live in fill in the blank. Yes, but what else? What other stories can we tell? And I think that was our task, to try to push us out of that rut.
Since the last time we worked together, he launched the Eviction Lab at Princeton, a database that represents the largest collection of U.S. eviction court records ever compiled for the public. The lab has since made headlines, with discoveries both startling and shaming. For this series, we're hitting the road, but since Matt, from his data lab, is functioning a bit as our Virgil, I thought you should get a sense of who he is. Because in charting his course so compellingly, Matt Desmond, like it or not, essentially has become America's eviction guy.
I'm that guy, yeah.
What made you that guy?
I don't know. I was raised in a small town in Arizona, and money was tight around our home and our table, but we always had enough, and we always had a story. And the story was about, you work hard, you go to college, you get a good job, America's here for you. America's fair, it's right. And I went to college with that story. And I thought I might want to be a lawyer. And I started taking classes in history and economics and sociology. And I got a different story. You know, I got a story about inequality. I got a story about the saliency of racism in America. I got a story about social mobility being higher in other parts of the world. You know, I was confronted with the question of, where do I live? You know, what country is this? And so I went to Arizona State University. I had to work my way through college, but when I wasn't working, I was in the library. And then I just started hanging out with homeless guys around my college campus. And
as one would do. I mean, why?
I think that for me, it was like, if you want to learn, you go to the sidewalk, you go to the street. Now, you don't just go to the library. I didn't really want even to meet folks' material needs. You know, there are a lot of folks in the community doing that or trying to do that. I wanted to hear them out. My senior year, I still had all these questions that I didn't think law school would answer. And that's what led me to become a sociologist, led me to study homelessness, and here we are today.
So you think the homelessness interest really acquired force because of the guys you met on the street in Tempe?
Maybe. I think there was probably something about my upbringing. I hated all the decisions that the family had to make when money was tight. A million decisions about what bills to cut and how to skimp a little here and hustle a little there. And I hated that constraint. I hated the stress it put on my parents. I hated the shame, I think, that the family could take on. I think that got in there somewhere, too. And I don't think it was just the friends I made on the streets of Tempe. You know, when I read about hunger in America, in a country that has so much, you know, in a country where that's unnecessary, Michael Harrington wrote about this a lot in The Other America. He talked a lot about the unnecessariness of all this suffering in America, and I resonate deeply with that.
Now, I know it's not about this for you, but I also know that anybody who does even a cursory reading of your bio is going to know at one point you guys didn't have a roof over your head.
You know, this isn't about me, but it felt like a little dishonest, you know, not to tell people that.
Mm-hmm.
So this happened when I was in college. We got underwater and my parents just stopped making the payments. You know, we really loved that home. I think it was a $60,000 home. It wasn't a lot of money, but you could see the little painted desert from it. And I remember Easter egg hunts in it and raising chickens, you know, in the backyard and growing pumpkins. They moved into a small rental in town. And I think that was, you know, that was a moment that was encased by shame and disappointment.
Mm-hmm. Conceptions that don't get challenged.
Yeah.
One myth is that evictions are filed only as a last resort.
Landlords are just making it, right? They're just scraping by. Is that true?
Let's talk about what you know.
That'll just take a minute. I know very little.
Well, the data that you've gathered has some inherent limitations, and that makes conclusions hard to draw. Some states didn't have or declined to share the data with you. Mm-hmm. And even though legal evictions are trackable, informal sort of cash and key evictions are not. So distinguish between those two and the numbers you can get and the numbers you can't.
All right. So, you know, when I was living in Milwaukee and I'd spent time with landlords, they had a lot of ways to evict a family. I spent a time with a landlord that would pay you to move and help you move. That's a pretty good eviction, you know, if you got to get evicted. I met a landlord that would just take your door off. Just imagine you don't have a front door. You're living in, you know, anywhere in the country. Mm-hmm. Just like, we need front doors on our homes. That got me thinking, gosh, okay, there's all these evictions that are processed through civil court, housing court, or eviction court. But there are all these evictions that no one sees. They occur in the shadow of the law, informal evictions, we call them. So we did a study in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and it's a big issue. For every formal eviction that goes to the court, at least in Milwaukee, there are two informal evictions that are executed.
Wow.
And so that's an inherent limitation in our data. Another inherent limitation is just the federal government doesn't collect numbers on evictions. If evictions are higher in Indianapolis than they are in El Paso, we have no idea. And so our little team here at Princeton started building this data set made up of these formal court-ordered evictions.
Mm-hmm.
We got about 83 million records, hustled, purchased data, and worked with states and worked with counties. We learned that there's eviction data stored in trailers in West Texas. You know, this is the state of our of our knowledge right now. But we tried to cobble them together and create the first ever data set of evictions in America. Now, 83 million evictions is a lot, but it's not everything.
Over what period?
From 2000 to now.
You told me that the rate of formal evictions seemed relatively flat, while the cost of rent climbed a steep upward path.
Yeah.
But if actual evictions are two or three times greater than that, maybe they've moved in tandem?
So, I mean, we're banging our heads against this problem in the lab, and I have no answer for you. This is a mystery to us. If you look at evictions across the last 15 years, the rate is pretty darn flat. Legal formal evictions. In some cities, there's movement, but you'd think if you have this drastic rise in rents and drastic rise in utility costs, you'd think that eviction line would move, and it just hasn't. And so it's a mystery for us. You know, I think that if you're living in Portland, Oregon, this really hot housing market, and the landlord raises the rent 30%, 40%, that's not an eviction. That's not going to show up in our records, but you probably can't live there anymore. We're missing that, and I think it's really important that we figure out other ways of kind of digging into this problem, but it's still something that we're like, don't fully understand yet.
Well, one thing that we know that more than four rent-burdened people in 10 spend more than half their paychecks on rent. Some spend 70%, some spend even 90%.
Right. If you're paying 50, 60, 70% of your income on rent, what are you not doing? And we now know from studies that are coming out of Johns Hopkins University and other places that the losers are the kids. When you're paying 30% of your income on rent and housing costs, you invest in your kids, you buy them school supplies, after-school activities. For me, you know, I've been studying this problem for a while, and one statistic that's just sobering is the clear finding about what families do when they finally move into public housing or receive a housing voucher that allows them to pay only 30% of their income instead of 60, 70, 80. And what they do with their freed-up money is just take it to the grocery store. And their kids, like, get healthier and they become less anemic. And so I think that one way to measure the housing crisis is through evictions. But another way has to be, even if the family isn't evicted, the housing crisis is still making their lives much harder day in, day out.
Well, here's something that confuses me. We know that the cost of rent has exceeded inflation for years. Mm-hmm. But why does the cost of low-income housing rise even faster than expensive apartments?
Where to start with this question? So in a lot of markets, the rent for an apartment located in the poorest neighborhood is not that different from the rent in a middle-class neighborhood or even the best neighborhoods in the city.
What do you mean, not that different? Are you saying that if you rent in a crappy part of town, a crappy apartment costs almost as much as a decent apartment in a decent part of town?
That's exactly what I'm saying. For example, in Milwaukee, a two-bedroom apartment in a very poor neighborhood, I'm talking poor, like 40% poverty or higher, the median rent for that place is about $600 right now.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to a middle-class neighborhood in Milwaukee, the median rent for a two-bedroom apartment is about $650. $50 more, and you get massively more safety, a lot less poverty, a lot better housing conditions.
Why is that?
Yeah, why is that, right? That's a huge question. One of the things we think is going on is landlords in low-income communities face higher risks. They are dealing with an older housing stock. They have a higher risk of non-payment. They have to confront the realities of poverty. Sometimes poverty can be violent. Sometimes poverty can mean drug addiction. They don't know, though, if you're going to be the risky tenant or if I'm going to be the risky tenant. So they might price up all their apartments to hedge for risk.
Mm-hmm.
But because that risk is still absolutely rare, it's more common, but it's still absolutely rare, most of that risk charge is just assumed as higher profits by landlords in poor neighborhoods.
How much higher profits?
We've been studying this through a nationally representative survey of landlords that the census does. And what we found is that you can take a property that's in an affluent neighborhood, like 8% or less poverty, and you can take a property that's in a poor neighborhood, 27% of poverty or more, vastly different kinds of neighborhoods. And you can subtract expenses from the rent, subtract everything you can think of, you know, roofing job, plumbing job, non-payment, vacancies. And the apartment in the poor neighborhood, after all expenses, still yields about double the profit than the apartment in an affluent neighborhood nationwide.
Wow. Well, then, why don't those poor people move to the better neighborhood?
You know, I spend a lot of time following around families after they get evicted and watching where they go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting. They don't start looking for housing in the worst neighborhoods.
They don't.
They're the most disadvantaged renters in the city. They get a fresh eviction smacked on their record. And they don't start looking for housing in the worst neighborhoods. They start in integrated neighborhoods, on the edges of the inner city, for example, if they're from the inner city, or they'll start in slightly nicer mobile home parks if they got evicted from a mobile home park. And then they get a bunch of rejections. They get no after no after no. And I remember spending time with a woman that I call Arlene in my book. After one eviction, she applied to 89 apartments, you know, before one person said yes. And by that time, you just take whatever you can get. And so a lot of folks are excluded from better off places, not on account of their income exclusively, but on account of their credit, on account of their eviction history or their conviction history. They might have done some time behind bars. and on account of their race. I mean, you know, social science can fill out a small library full of studies about the saliency of racial discrimination today.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's not that poor, especially poor people of color, it's not that they're living in the worst neighborhoods because they're the only places they can afford. It's because they're allowed to live there. And you know what's weird? It's always been this way. You know, if you go back and you read like Jacob Riis, How the Other Half Lives, right?
Yeah.
It's in New York City, it's 1890s. The rent in the tenements is actually higher than better apartments uptown. You see this again and again and again. Tom Segrew, historian at New York University, has this book about Detroit. And he shows that as late as 1960, rents in black neighborhoods were higher than rents for better apartments in white neighborhoods in Detroit. Era after era, this kind of pattern repeats itself, and then we're confronted with it again, and then we puzzle over it. Like, it's a new thing. It's not a new thing.
When we first talked about this, you said that you could superimpose a map of the Great Migration over a map of the highest eviction areas today, and the contours would almost exactly match.
I mean, that was chilling for me, just chilling. When we first got these national data and we mapped it on the United States, I don't really know what I was expecting, but I had spent a lot of time in Milwaukee. I thought evictions were incredibly high there. 1 in 14 renter homes in the inner city of Milwaukee is evicted every year formally, right? Huge amount. You walk down any inner city block, look on your left, look on your right, one of those families is not going to be there by the end of the year. You crunch the numbers and you look, and Milwaukee isn't even in the top 50 highest evicting cities in the country. You see South Carolina exploding, North Carolina exploding, Georgia, up the Mississippi to Detroit. Tulsa, Oklahoma is in the top 20. Albuquerque, New Mexico, I think 1 in 21 renter homes is evicted.
These aren't hot markets.
These aren't hot markets, right? Who in God's name is talking about Albuquerque and Tulsa when we're talking about the housing crisis? The main finding is this old American story, the systematic dispossession of poor people of color from the land. It's really interesting. You know, if you rented a home on the north side of Milwaukee, your rent would be $700. If you bought that home in a conventional mortgage, your mortgage payment would be about $70. You know, there's this idea of like, wait, you know, could we expand homeownership to low-income families? Could they afford it? And it's like, compared to what? You know, I was talking to a nonprofit organization the other day, and they wanted to invest in Baltimore. Do you think we can invest in homeownership opportunities for low-income families in Baltimore as a wealth builder? And I said, as a wealth builder, I don't know. But as an approach to the affordable housing crisis, absolutely. You know, that house might not be worth a lot more than it is now in 30 years if you're talking about investing in the most distressed communities. But to stabilize those communities, to say this is your house, you're going to pay a lot less for it, but it'll be worth a lot more to you. It's not the only solution, but I think it should be on the table.
Ultimately, any stable neighborhood gets gentrified.
Did you say any stable neighborhood could be gentrified?
I think so.
Do you live in Brooklyn?
Yeah.
That's what happened. But Brooklyn's the weird thing.
You know,
Brooklyn's the weird thing. Gentrification, by which we mean Harlem, U Street Corridor, the Mission District in San Francisco, is gentrifying. It affects the cities that most of our reporters and academics live in, you know? And so we focus on it a lot. But a lot of cities around the country, gentrification is not the concern. And most evictions are not occurring in gentrifying neighborhoods. You know, they're occurring in poor, segregated neighborhoods where even there folks can't afford a roof over their head. So if we care about displacement and instability and school mobility, gentrification isn't top order.
Touché. You have just shown me what has frustrated you about so much of the coverage of this issue, which is that it's done by people like me who live in urban areas whose problems are specific to those zones.
No, that's right. That's exactly right. I was listening to a podcast the other day, smart folks, and they're in D.C., and they're talking about the housing crisis. And they couldn't help themselves but just kind of keep referencing D.C. as their lodestar. I love D.C. I think it's a really important city, too. But D.C., New York, San Francisco, they are not like Tulsa and Albuquerque and Richmond, Virginia, although those three cities have much higher eviction rates. And so I think we need a language like of humility about the housing crisis a little bit. Like, we kind of recognize that the health market is complicated. It's tricky to get your hands around. And I think we need that kind of reverence for the housing market, that it's tricky and it's not just about neoclassical economics. And if we live in a place like Chicago or San Francisco or in LA, we might think about going to Indianapolis once in a while.
What does eviction mean? What does home mean? It's not something that's easily talked about. Who else other than that guy to tell me?
I was talking with my 9-year-old the other day. He just had something cool happen. You know, he had a victory happen in his life. And I said, hey, did you tell your friends at school about it? And he said, no, I didn't. And I said, why not? And he said, well, you know, at school, you kind of have to act. And at home, you kind of like you're yourself. You know, I think that's what home is, where we're our true selves, where we let down, where we relax. And the absence of that, where home is something that is a complete burden, is a monkey on our back in the form of rent we can barely afford, where you're spending most of your income to rent a place that has roaches or plumbing doesn't work or the door falls down. I think that has an effect on us that makes us feel small and not ourselves, not our full, beautiful selves. Home for me is the wellspring of a lot of social problems, and it's the promise. It's where we've rooted the American dream. And I think like that went awry down the road, but the impulse behind that was not wrong.
Psychologists believe that place identity forms the basis of self-identity, that home, wherever, whatever it is, establishes, interrogates, confirms, and ultimately shapes our view of who we are. So home is under your roof and on your street, but it's also in your head with the ultimate power to sustain or to scar you. But you knew that. Like, I love my home. We've lived here 24 years, raised the kids here, planned to die here. But when a hard rain bounces off the roof and rattles the windows, that's when I feel gut-level gratitude. There's a Victorian expression, safe as houses, which back then meant certain beyond a doubt. Would that were so. Evictions are pouring through America's roof like rain down a subway grate, leaving our house lousy with mold.
Hello, Sheriff's Department, eviction, come to the door.
No, no, open the door. You gotta let us in first.
Open the door.
God damn it, credit.
And this is ridiculous. I don't have nowhere to go, no nothing, and this is how they...
You dress like you're going out for the day. You want to walk around?
Like, I explained to them that my husband just passed and everything. When I told them that...
I want them off my property now. You're not going to be in my house ever again.
You go back in there without his permission, he's going to call South Holland PD, and you're going to get arrested for trespassing.
In the next few weeks, you'll hear us on the ground in Chicago, Atlanta, Indianapolis, Camden, New Jersey, and Richmond, Virginia. And what you'll take away, we hope, is a whole new way to frame the issue of eviction, one that extends beyond the basic rules of the market to the courts and the legislature, the very foundations of the nation. Because eviction isn't just a plague. It's a prism that refracts and reveals who we are. Oh, it's a plague too, but we can treat it. It most certainly is treatable. Just because it's always been with us doesn't mean it has to be.
The Scarlet E is produced by Eve Claxton, John Hanrahan, and Catherine Simon. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer, Sam Baer. Our original score was composed by Mark Phillips. We had more help from Emily Mann, Megan Pauly, Greta Rainbow, and the Eviction Lab team.
On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Feder, and Astor Chetivetti, with help from Zandra Ellen and Chloe Nosan. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for The Scarlet E is provided by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the Melville Charitable Trust. Additional support is provided by the Economic Hardship Reporting Project and Chasing the Dream, a WNET initiative reporting on poverty and opportunity in America. Support for On the Media is provided by the Ford Foundation and the listeners of WNYC Radio.